Okay.
I just wanted to get clarification. I spoke earlier about the Farm Bureau proposal that was submitted on December 3rd, and I think I showed very clearly that the milestones did not include any indicators of effectiveness of management practices at individual farms to show control of discharges or pollution reduction. And from the proposal, from the presentation I just heard,
slow down.
I'll start over. I just wanted to clarify that I didn't...
Slow down.
That this presentation sounds like it has the same milestones as the December 3rd submitted alternative that we evaluated, and that earlier in my presentation comments, I demonstrated that relative to the draft order does not have any indicators of effectiveness of management practices or pollution control reduction from individual farms included, and none of that to be reported to the regional board. Could you explain that?
I guess I could say, other than having every individual actually having their operations audited to determine what they are actually implementing and if they are implementing appropriate and effective management practices in conjunction with professionals, I would consider that a fairly large milestone to make sure that people are actually implementing management practices. So that would be a major part of the program here as compared to any, you know, milestone that has been discussed in other orders.
The difference being our milestones are water quality based. The difference being our milestones are water quality based largely, and in your proposal they are not. They are implementation management, implementation of management practices, and as your slide here says, for instance, you'd provide names of participants in good standing. So one of the comments we would get if this was our proposal was, what does good standing mean? And number of operations audited in a 12-month period, audited for what? You know, those are the kind of questions we would get. Well, and what we have to tie it back to is water quality standards and meeting water quality standards, not implementing practices.
You know, I'd like to just draw this portion of the proceeding to a close because we have so many others to get to. It's important. I think, at least from my perspective, I think we're going to ask them to submit their attachment to you so that we can have you look at it, and we're going to have more opportunity to discuss it when we continue this meeting. We're not going to finish it today. There's no question about that. I just want to get through with as many presentations as we can today. So thank you. The Strawberry Commission is up. And how is our reporter doing? You tell me when you need a break. Okay, you just say stop, all right? And we'll stop.
What time did you say? 3:30.
3:30. Okay.
I think I've got it here. Okay.
Erwin.
Yep. Yeah, so just the forward one click.
Oh, go ahead. If you're ready, go ahead. Okay, folks.
Okay, Chairman Young?
Yes.
Vice Chairman Jeffries, Member Hodgen, Dr. Hunter. My name is Rick Tomlinson with the California Strawberry Commission. I have Dr. Michael Kahn with me today. We wanted to address several specific issues related to strawberries. First, before I even begin, I want to make clear we strongly support the previous coalition effort that was just described. We think there are so many errors with the current staff proposal that it is not implementable. And so I'm going to point out some errors in the staff proposal that we would like specifically addressed regarding strawberries, But overall, we believe that the only workable resolution is that coalition approach that was previously described. So the first part is just on Appendix F. The staff did an economic analysis. I think you're all familiar with the profile of strawberries in Region 3. Roughly half of all the nation's strawberries come out of Region 3. There's about 320 family farmers with an average farm size of 75 acres. Out of the whole area, we only represent about 5% of irrigated acreage. That's our 2011 acreage. In Appendix F, the staff developed a case study on strawberries. We were the only commodity that they did that with. We went to verify that case study, and the first thing that we identified was that the source data that was cited doesn't exist. There is no 2010 document. There's a 1999 document. Dr. Bardot also identified that the information that does come up on the website that you click was not understood well and misused. We had Dr. Richard Green, a professor at UC Davis, further evaluate it. I have a letter from him I can submit so I don't have to take the time to read it. I have some excerpts here in the presentation. But I think the header on the top there in the staff analysis says that strawberries are inelastic, that consumers will attempt to buy it no matter the price. I have 320 farmers that would love that to be the truth. We all know that's not the truth. Another part of the strawberry profile, I mentioned we're 5% of the irrigated acreage, and the staff really focused on chlorpyrifos and diazinon. We're about 1% of the combined use of chlorpyrifos and diazinon in the entire area. But to trace back the previous staff proposals, if you'll recall, the one that came out in May 2010, that proposal would have eliminated all strawberry production because it included a standard that we couldn't achieve. It's since become something that is, I'll say, within the range of possibility, but again, still many problems. Relative to the groundwater and nitrate, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Kahn to describe some of his recent work.
Good afternoon, Chairman and the Board. My name's Michael Kahn. I'm an Irrigation Water Resources Advisor for the Central Coast. I'm with UC Cooperative Extension. Work with many of the growers in the room here. Let's see here. Because of a lack of information on current practices on management of nitrogen and water in strawberries for the modern varieties that are now grown on the Central Coast, Tim Hartz, who's with UC Davis, and myself worked collaboratively with the regional board. We received a grant from the board to evaluate current practices. And one of the first aspects or objectives of this project was to evaluate how much nitrogen is actually uptaken by the modern varieties that are grown in the Watsonville, Salinas, and Santa Maria area. So a number of fields, commercial fields, we followed the crop uptake through monthly whole plant samples. These samples were divided in vegetative material as well as fruit material to determine the nitrogen content. This data here shows for the fields that we monitored in Santa Maria and in Watsonville, this linear uptake of nitrogen sort of peaking out at about 100 pounds of nitrogen per acre when we get to the end of the production season. We also evaluated the amount of nitrogen that's uptaken by the fruit, exported through the fruit, and that amounts to about 92 pounds of nitrogen per acre. In total, we reach about 200 pounds of nitrogen per acre through the season, through the production season. Then we surveyed commercial growers. We had 28 in total about their nitrogen fertilizer use records. And this graph just shows the the variation in nitrogen inputs by different growers, on average, they used a total of 192 pounds of nitrogen per acre for the whole season. This is roughly in balance with the uptake pattern of strawberries. So the nitrogen that's actually put on the field is being taken up in the production. If we look at the soil nitrate levels through the season in some of these fields, we see once we get into the main part of the production season, April through August, the soil nitrate levels are quite low. And this is just more evidence that what's being put on the field in terms of fertilizer is quite in balance with what's being taken up by the crop. Another question is, the vehicle for moving this nitrate down into the aquifer is water, right, through percolation. So we wanted to know how much water are growers applying to strawberry fields. We worked with the industry to put flow meters on roughly 34 commercial fields, and 17 of those fields we more intensively monitored with data loggers and evaluated the crop water use through ET estimates. And you can see the data logger right there in the middle of the field. This is a summary of the data for these 34 fields. Roughly an average of 21 inches are used. You see quite a range in water use, but we can put that terms in terms of crop ET to look at what the water requirements were of the strawberry crop. We put in terms of crop ET for these 17 more intensively monitored fields. See, on average, growers are applying 93% of crop ET. In other words, they were actually under-irrigating a little bit. Only a small minority are applying more than 120% of crop ET. So, again, the amount of water that's being applied. Do you have a question?
Yeah, just quickly. ET.
Oh, crop ET is evapotranspiration or the water use requirement of the crop. Okay, so roughly what's being applied is what's being used in terms of water. So that would also suggest there's very little drainage that's happening below the root zone of the strawberry fields that we evaluated. So just in summary, what we've learned so far, and there's a report also available that we submitted to the board, to the staff, the nitrogen uptake of strawberries, the applied fertilizer, and the uptake are in balance in the majority of the fields that we looked at. The average soil nitrate levels were below 10 parts per million nitrate, and many of the fields actually were below 5 parts per million, suggesting, again, that the crop is doing a good job scavenging most of the nitrogen that growers are applying. Applied water volumes are in check with the water use of the crop. And so as a whole, if you take these results, they do indicate in their preliminary study that currently how growers are managing the fields has pretty minimal risk to nitrate loading to the groundwater.
And so what was there any part of your study that looked at post-harvest period, and I don't, if you could define what that is, how long a period it is, and is that, does that occur during the rainy season, and are there factors there that we need to know more about?
After harvest, that field is going to be rotated to another crop of either strawberries or it will go back to vegetables. If it goes to strawberries, as you end that crop, it has very low nitrate levels in the soil, so there is low risk when the rainfall comes to leach what's in the soil.
And so is there any, there's no, what's the longest fallow period for a strawberry field?
The longest fallow period?
Yeah.
They would typically probably plant the next put a cover crop in, mm-hmm. if they're going to go strawberries, mm-hmm. and then probably in June or July, at least in this area, start setting up that field for planting again. In many cases, they're rotating with vegetable crops, so it might go right into vegetables in as early as, March or April, or mm-hmm. it could be a little bit earlier. But that soil would come in with low nitrate levels.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Jeffries? Yes. My understanding that you're saying that there is no nitrates or nitrogen going below the root zone with strawberries?
We're not saying there's nothing going down. We're saying these are indicators based on the criteria the staff was talking about before that strawberry growers are already meeting. Okay, the 1.2 balance, a majority of the growers are meeting that balance. That's all we're saying. There could be some loss of nitrogen because there is nitrate in that soil.
Right.
And we monitored for the whole season. I'm giving you numbers that are the average for the whole season. There can be individual irrigation events. You might lose a little water. But the indication here is that the current practices growers are using in strawberries is fairly well in check with what we understand of best management practices. And, in fact, if you're asking growers to reduce their water use or their nitrogen use from where they are now, in my opinion, they wouldn't be able to do that without reducing yields. They're okay. already using very good practices. Yeah. Is what
the water use, you showed 21 inches plus.
What's that?
From your water use was 21 or 22 inches per year. Is that correct on the average?
That's right.
And that was from January through October?
That's correct.
Is that including rainfall or is that pumped?
That's pumped water.
So you don't include the rainwater?
No, that's just applied water. The rainfall occurred roughly from January to March last year. That was when 90% of the rainfall occurred. The growers didn't irrigate significantly until about April.
And rotation of strawberry crops is what, usually 3 to 5 years? Depends the type of plant?
How often?
Yes, how often do they rotate?
I'll let the Strawberry Commission
It's going to vary dramatically depending
by the
upon
type of plant.
If you're the owner and you're just growing strawberries and doing a cover crop and just coming back in 8 months, or if you're going immediately into vegetables and then coming back to that ground in a couple years.
Well, are you indicating that you transplant strawberry plants every year?
Absolutely. So we plant every year, and it's a roughly 14-month cycle. So there's no immediate back-to-back. You have to constantly be rotating with something else, whether that be a cover crop or whether that be with vegetables. And so we're in constant rotation with vegetables.
Okay.
And just to add, right, this is an example of what Dr. Letty was talking about and why we wanted to address this as I called it an error in the report, where the staff did not do a comprehensive nitrate evaluation to identify risk. So what you see in the staff report is that strawberries are designated as high risk for leaching nitrate to groundwater, and when in fact the evidence here is we're making it no worse. Right. This is just the first year of a study. We need more work, but certainly to characterize us as high risk would not be fair.
Let me get this straight, Mr. Thomason. You're telling me that you rotate strawberry plants every 14 months, and then those plants are disked up, and there's a cover crop or there's another type of crop that's put in for another season, and then you come back and transplant the strawberry crop back in again. Is
yes.
that what you're telling me?
Yes. There's roughly, depending upon where you're at in Santa Maria or in the Watsonville, Salinas area, anywhere from, say, 21 to 24,000 plants per acre to maybe up to 30,000 plants in 1 acre that are planted each year. And in each growing region, it's at different times because they're trying to hit different market windows and go with the climate. And so, yes.
Okay.
Right, but part of that, the reason why that works is, right, it's not a magic crop. We're not the only crop that can somehow absorb 100% of the fertilizer that's applied, right? It's because we're in this constant rotation system. It's because maybe there might be some nitrogen in terms of the water that's coming up. There might be some in the residual. When you ask questions of Danny Merkley about what does a good farmer do, this is an example. They look at what's already there. They don't apply more than what they need. They don't make it any worse than what they got it. Right? This is an example of what I would characterize as low risk to groundwater. Certainly, I would ask you to make the changes to the order that would say we're not high risk.
Well, listen to Dr. Lady.
L-E-T-U-Y.
I was going to ask him the question because he talked about nitrogen or nitrates getting down past the root zone. Would that mean to a farmer that he should subsoil every year and bring that up, the ground over?
And that's what he was part of his answer, right, is that each crop is going to have a different set of practices to try and reduce risk for groundwater because we all need to achieve those goals, but it's all going to look different for each commodity. For here, for strawberries, we have a drip irrigation system that's highly efficient.
That's obvious. Thank you.
Mr. Hodgen.
Dr. Kahn, your statement here suggests that strawberries really are not a major contribution to groundwater pollution, but do you have any figures on the same fields to know what the level of contamination is in the groundwater?
Did we evaluate the nitrate level?
Did you evaluate them? Where I'm going is that an area that's below those strawberry fields? Is that contaminated groundwater under there, which may or may not have anything to do with the strawberry production?
We did evaluate the irrigation water for nitrate levels. I can't recollect exactly the levels, but none of them were very high. I mean, they were meeting the water quality standards, the drinking water standards of 10 parts per million in these fields.
So you were testing the water that's being used to irrigate the fields?
That's right. So I don't know if there were other wells around that are shallower. They might have higher nitrate. I have no idea.
Thank you.
Member Hodgen, your question is an excellent question because it's an example of why I say even strawberries here with the low risk that we're describing to you, how challenging it would be for us to comply because the vast majority, 70-80% of strawberry farmers are leasing their ground. They're constantly moving. And so in any given year, they might be on a farm where the groundwater below has nitrate in it from production practices 20 or 30 or 40 years ago that have no correlation to them or maybe even the crop before it or what was going on. So trying to tie that correlation to groundwater and then what's going on top, there isn't that immediate correlation. That's why a whole systems approach is more effective than an individual farm measuring groundwater and somehow suggesting that there's a correlation between that farm and that groundwater.
If I'm not mistaken, I thought staff put up a slide that showed that the nitrate levels in groundwater in this area were increasing year by year.
I think if you look at the Gamma database, what you'll find is that varies dramatically well by well, and it's shifting. I think you had testimony at your previous workshop that suggested that it was shifting, and certainly in some wells it's increasing some areas. In some areas it may be decreasing as well.
Well, shifting in what way? Well, I know shifting means moving, but I mean going up and down. Okay. So what about if you're looking at the groundwater basin and you averaged all these wells, so you were taking into consideration the ups and the downs?
I think that would have been an excellent analysis for the staff to do, but instead what they presented to you was the highest level of detection ever in 25 years, and so they presented you data that in some cases was decades old. So you're left with the impression that all of these wells are above drinking water standard, when in fact you go to the GAMMA database today and it'll show that the vast majority are not. And if you go to those USGS studies that were done just a few years ago, it'll show that the vast majority of wells are in compliance, that yes, there is nitrate in groundwater, yes, it needs to be addressed, yes, we need to work on it, but it's not the picture that you've been presented.
Well, are there nitrate levels that are exceeding drinking water standards?
I'm sure there are. And some of it, I would estimate, I'm not a groundwater hydrologist, but I would estimate that agriculture has contributed at some point, maybe currently. There are many other sources as well.
I just want to ask staff, what's with the GAMMA data? I mean, we're hearing people claim that staff has kind of picked and choose data, you know, ignored GAMMA data. I mean, can you guys clarify what we're hearing?
I can.
Go ahead.
Let me try and answer that. Maybe Matt can provide some additional clarification if necessary. So what the GAMMA data set is, and there's several parts of GAMMA. There's a groundwater basin public supply well study, which is these deeper wells, which is these what we would call meso maps showing you here on the screen. There's special studies, which are focused on contaminants typically, like nitrate, like which is what the Lawrence Livermore studies are doing. And then there's domestic well studies. For example, those studies that detected high levels of nitrates, for example, in Tulare County. The groundwater public supply well analyses, those are all deep public supply wells, typically from older groundwater, and so it takes some amount of time because they're deeper wells for contamination to reach them. What is missing from that database is the shallow wells, and so we don't see the shallow well impact, although the special studies part of GAMMA has looked at shallow wells and has found that nitrate impacts are happening in shallow groundwater within the last 2 to 10 years, so in the current time frame. In addition, what the GAMMA data set is challenged by is that as wells are abandoned because they go out of service due to high levels of nitrate contamination, for example, they drop off the radar screen. And what DPH presented to the state board last month is that those wells are no longer represented. It's an artifact of the data set. It does not mean that groundwater is getting cleaned up. And in fact, most of those wells, if you sampled on a bore right next to where the well used to be, is still high levels of nitrate. Nitrate pollution doesn't assimilate very quickly. And so that's some of the complication of the data set.
I would agree that the situation is not exactly as we presented it, in the sense that it's worse than we presented it. It is worse than we presented it. Old wells that are contaminated go out of production, and they are not sampled any longer. They are abandoned. New wells come into play. And if you sample those new wells, it's going to present a picture of cleaner water than is actually there.
Okay. I think his name is it Dolezal? Mr. Dolezal had presented two side-by-side slides comparing the Santa Maria area. Yours was on the left, his was on the right. There was a marked difference in the number of blue dots, if you want to just characterize it that way. What's the difference from your perspective on the presentation of those two data sets? I mean, one suggests that you didn't include a whole bunch of wells, and therefore the percentage of contaminated wells from his presentation should be much lower than what you presented.
We would have to look at the data set side by side. The slide's no longer here in front of me. I'd have to look at it in greater detail. However, it would depend upon which wells were being represented in each study, at which time period. So in any given five-year time frame, there's a whole different set of wells that come into play.
Well, he had the same time frames from what I remember. At least it was a number of years compared identically, if I'm not mistaken.
I think what's important here to remember is that the fact that there's a nitrate groundwater pollution problem is not being debated We can talk about the level of pollution that there is, but I can show you several slides from presentations from technical service providers just recently, which are all conveying the same thing about the nitrate groundwater pollution problem. What we don't have great data about is the shallow groundwater pollution that's going on, which would be representative of current practices, and the data that we do have also shows a problem. I am interested in the Strawberry Commission's data and taking a closer look at that. And what I'm also interested in understanding is, for those growers who do not meet the nitrate balance ratio of 1.2, for example, what amount of nitrate loading is coming from those fields?
There was a very small minority that were above that 1.2. I believe maybe 5 out of the 34 fields. So it was a small number. I think it came out to about 12%.
And I think previous reports that the staff have cited would suggest that about half of nitrate that might go below the root zone goes through a denitrification process naturally. And so the amount that then leaches to the groundwater is going to be a function of the amount of surface water applied. So it would be a combination of a grower, one, having excess fertilizer, and then two, overwatering. If those two things didn't happen, if you just had the excess fertilizer, then it would be the rate of natural rainfall or the rate of flow from a subsequent crop. And then you'd have a certain amount, I think the studies that the staff have cited, about half, that gets through a natural denitrification process.
Okay. You guys still have 6 minutes.
And yes, and if I could just add one more thing, because you asked.
You have 6 minutes okay. To go ahead. And
well, okay, I will. Okay. Thank you. One of the questions that you had asked previously was about the Dolezal report. I was concerned that if we were going to present that information to you today, that we triple-checked it. We hired a groundwater hydrology firm to peer review Mr. Dolezal's work, his memo, and I'll read a quick sentence. We agree with the conclusion of the Dolezal report that the presentation, the staff presentation, distorts the facts related to the source, degree, and extent of nitrate contamination in groundwater, and that additional unbiased analysis is needed to support policy decisions and development of best management practices for nitrate sources to groundwater. I'll offer that as well to you. If I could return to the presentation, so in regards to nitrate, we would ask that you please correct the order if you move forward with this version or any other version regarding the designation of strawberries as high risk for loading to groundwater for nitrates. Also, I wanted to talk briefly about the tiering criteria, and this would be a typical strawberry farmer. So if you consider the square box, a strawberry farm, and the blue line on the bottom, a river, let's say that's the Pajaro River, let's say the left is some tributary, let's say the right is the lower Pajaro with a levee on it, that would be a typical strawberry farmer who would be in Tier 1. If you happen to have that same strawberry farmer, whether you had an organic field or a conventional field that, again, was not applying chlorpyrifos or diazinon, who is 500 feet away from that river, maybe even a river that's got a levee on it, or maybe instead of a 25-foot buffer or 30 or 50-foot buffer, they decided to put a berm or a ditch or a retention pond, it wouldn't matter. That farmer would be Tier 2. Same farm. If that farmer happened to be in a co-op, and that co-op had other farmers that were over 1,000 acres, they would now be in Tier 3, even if they were 2,000 feet away from the river. Same farm, no chlorpyrifos, no diazinon. This is an example of the arbitrary nature of the currently proposed tiering criteria, where the overwhelming focus on toxicity, the evidence that's currently been accumulated over the last 5 to 6 years, is that chlorpyrifos and diazinon are the two pesticides that are the primary source of toxicity. What the others are, what the detection versus toxicity, I don't know. But clearly the staff has identified that these two have. But when you look at how the criteria applies to a farmer that doesn't use them, You could have the same farmer be a tier 1, 2, or 3, and that just doesn't make sense to us. That's an example of why I was saying at the beginning, Dr. Hunter, about why this is just so problematic for us. You could then have another strawberry farmer, because I mentioned we represent about 1%. There are some farms about 6%. Mr. Jeffries, you asked about crops going back to back. About 6% of the strawberry crops stay in the ground for 2 years. Those folks have a higher pest pressure. They might resort to something like chlorpyrifos and diazinon to deal with that. That would be a very important product for them to be able to use. They might be 3,000 feet away from the river, they'd be in tier two. So if you were to stick with the current staff order, the one thing that you might do is delete the definition of operation, and everywhere it appears in the order, just simply replace it with landowner or farm, and that eliminates all those tier three people who, you know, would otherwise be just fine having no risk, but somehow being captured in this definition of operation. Another thing that you might do is, if you look at your tiering criteria for 1A and 1B about not using chlorpyrifos and diazinon, if you're not using it, if those are the primary source of toxicity, then what does it really matter whether that farm not using it is 500 feet away or 1,000 feet away? Again, there's other tools they can use besides buffers to come into compliance. Also, a lot of the sediment management requirements are all in Tier 1. So there's not some big dramatic difference there between Tier 2 and Tier 1 in terms of sediment management. So if you remove the 1,000 foot from tier 1, that would allow some of those folks from Tier 2 to move back down into Tier 1. The last thing you might do is look at Tier 2 A and B, and then look at Tier 3. If you just simply removed the Tier 3 language for surface water down to Tier 2, that's what the staff is identifying as something that they're trying to address, which is they're trying to address an immediate discharger, someone who's immediately discharging water with chlorpyrifos and diazinon into a water body. Again, we would suggest that the overall coalition approach is much better. I'm just saying, if you're going to move forward with the order that's been presented to you, these are the types of changes that need to occur.
And do the other farms that are not using these two chemicals, are they using another pesticide in that list?
I'm sure some of them are. But the data, again, is not conclusive on what it, is it a detection? Is it toxicity? But these are the examples why a coalition, when we would look at an audit for a coalition approach, we would be looking at all of the pesticides. We wouldn't just be looking at chlorpyrifos and diazinon.
Okay. All right, you've got about another minute and 15 seconds.
All right. This is a summary of the changes that I've described. Okay. First two regarding attachment A, page 13, paragraph 51, and attachment A, page 48, paragraph 10, regarding the nitrate component. The other two are in regards to the surface water, the changes to the tiering criteria. The last one, which is page 13, paragraph 12, this is a brand new paragraph that just emerged 2 weeks ago that would give the executive officer authority to completely change the tiers at any time over the next 5 years. We can't live with that type of unpredictability, whether it's adding the next 10, the next 73, adding five more tiers, collapsing two tiers, or whatever. That type of unpredictability is just, we can't live with that. And so we would ask that you strike that paragraph too. Lastly, I would just say, relative to the coalition approach, if you think about what was described to you in terms of audits, I would suggest that you look at the other clause that referenced the sustainability program, because it is very, very similar. So if it's good enough for a wine grape grower to move from Tier 3 to Tier 1 or Tier 2 to Tier 1, why isn't it good enough for any of the other commodities?
Are there other commodities that have developed sustainability certifications?
There are many other commodities working on those right now. There's a sustainability stewardship index. And in addition to that, though, if you just simply look at the practices that are required, the coalition approach is very similar to what that sustainability program looks like. In fact, there's no groundwater monitoring in the sustainability program, and the staff recommended that as a vehicle for a wine grape grower to move from Tier 3 or Tier 2 into Tier 1. So again, if you just simply look at that, you'll find that what we've proposed to you is what the staff has said is acceptable in other situations.
Thank you. Francis, did you have a question or a comment?
I just have a request that, and maybe it's already happened, that you leave your PowerPoint presentation with the staff and test the same with yours. Your PowerPoint presentation is okay. We just need it for the record.
Okay. And did you want me to leave these three letters?
You can give them to Michael.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for your presentation. Coast Keeper is next. We've given them 24 minutes. Do you want your break, Ms. Reporter? Would you like the break right now? Okay. You want to take a break?
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take the break. Okay.
10 minutes?
10-minute break. 10-minute break. Okay, Coast Keeper is up. Folks, please take your seats. If you want to continue talking, you can do so outside. No more cards. Okay, well. Water standard for groundwater recharge. Is it in Spanish? The NOI? Okay. Just, Steve, before you start, question for Lisa and staff. I think this is a good question someone just submitted on a card here. Is the NOI form and the annual form, any reporting forms, are they also available in Spanish?
That is a great question. The NOI form, so the annual compliance form is not yet developed. It's
right,
included as part of this proposed order.
The NOI.
The NOI is complete. 1,400 of the 1,700 operations have already submitted an update via the electronic NOI. The instructions are all in Spanish. We have provided assistance to Spanish growers in three different opportunities now, and also they have come to our office. The form itself online is not yet in Spanish, but we plan to put it online in Spanish.
Might be helpful. I mean, I think people should be responding in English. I mean, submitting forms in English, but I think that there should be maybe something on the form itself that lets them know that they can get explanatory information that's in Spanish and where that is.
On the transmittal form, there's this number that you call if you need Spanish assistance, as well as the instruction form that's in Spanish.
Okay. All right, Mr. Shimek. 24 minutes.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Steve Shimek, and I'm here representing a kind of a collective group of comments, although some of these people will be offering individual comments. So I'm here representing Environmental Defense Center, Environmental Justice Coalition for Water, Monterey Coast Keeper, Santa Barbara Channel Keeper, and Environment in the Public Interest. First of all, just very quickly, times have changed. Things are no longer the way that they used to be. But there used to be a lot of water in areas like the Lower Salinas and some of these other watersheds. The watersheds have changed a lot. Some of the way that the landscape looked, it was much more resilient. And in some ways, with new regulation, what we're trying to do is not go back in the Wayback Machine. We can't do that. But we are trying to restore some of the function of our watersheds. There are also uses that no longer exist on some of our rivers and streams. And again, the rivers and streams, they just don't look the way they used to, and they just don't function the way that they used to. This is Tembladero Slough. This is not the Salinas River, but that's the condition that we have on some of our waterways today. You have lots of algae. You have rodent traps. You have bare earth banks. You have farming very near the waterway. Just as a note, this is a dead sea otter. I kind of, as you know, I represent environmental interests to a great extent. And last year, 26 dead sea otters washed ashore, and they died of microcystis poisoning. Microcystis is a freshwater algae that becomes toxic and blooms in high nitrate conditions, washes into the ocean, is concentrated by mussels and bivalves. The otters eat it and die. So in other words, the toxicity that we're seeing in our and high nitrates that we're seeing in our freshwater is reaching into the ocean. I'm about to add some of the confusion on wells and water, but this slide existed before I showed up here today. In the Salinas Valley in Monterey County, as some of you know, we have been trying to work cooperatively, although it has not turned that way, with Monterey County Water Resources Agency trying to get their well water data. The data that we have received is old data. This data does exist by aquifer, so I do have that. I don't have it on this slide. But it's essentially 28% of the wells in Monterey County in the Salinas aquifer are above drinking water standard, 28%.
Are those public wells?
So it's not clear, and we could not get clarity. It is a mix. I believe it is a mix. So what the statement reads in the report is that some are domestic wells, some are irrigation wells. There is no breakout of how many of each. We also know that we had an economist up earlier, and he talked about the impact of nitrates to and resolving this problem to farmers. Well, I want to make the point that there is impact on people as well, and this presents real costs. This is a study that was literally just released. I have copies of the executive summary that I can leave, I guess, with Michael, is what I've heard. For you to have. But basically, it's talking about costs in the millions and millions and millions of dollars. And this isn't cleanup. This is to treat the water so that it is in a drinkable situation. When we set out on this process, the goals were quite simple. The goals were to eliminate toxic discharges of ag pesticides to surface and groundwaters, reduce, and I want to emphasize that word, nutrient discharges to surface waters, reduce nutrient discharges to groundwater, minimize sediment, protect aquatic habitat. Frankly, I believe that these are goals that could be embraced by everyone. These are the goals that were set out in the letter that was sent out in 2008. These are still the goals that we're trying to achieve today. There is sometimes a lot of rhetoric that talks about the fact that we can't do this tomorrow. No one's asking anyone to do this tomorrow. That is pure rhetoric. So if you look at no regulation versus total regulation, now this is my opinion, but the 2004 waiver was kind of a three, you know? So then there was the February 2010 waiver, which I think was somewhere right around the seven. Then there was the November 2010 waiver, which I think was right in the middle. And then there was the March 2011 waiver, which I think, again, was somewhere right in the middle of regulation. But I think this misses the point. This is the slide that you saw earlier, and this is the elephant in the room. Where are you? If that 2011 draft agricultural order is a slider, where are you going to put it? That's the elephant in the room. And I would suggest it needs to be further out to the right. Agriculture would suggest it needs to be further to the left. That's the tension. That's the reality. But if you compare it to the other programs, I think I think that it needs to be at least as much as what the municipal, what you're asking municipal cities and stormwater permits to do. At least at that same level. You're asking the cities to do it. why aren't you asking ag to do it? So our organizations continue to support adoption of the February 2010 draft order, as it is the most protective. It's the one that basically says the long list of toxic chemicals, everybody needs to do individual monitoring, everybody needs to do the same thing. We need to do a lot, and we need to do a lot more. Our organizations do support this order, this current draft, with certain conditions. So my talk is about to get very dense, and I'm sorry. So tiering. According to Table 5 on page 23 of the staff report, Tier 3 is expected to include about 54% of the acreage, 13% of the farms. So how do we keep that from sliding? If it either doesn't capture enough because the staff estimates are slightly off, or if people start to maybe game the system a little bit or change the pesticides that they use, how do we backstop and make sure that we capture enough people in Tier 3? So we are suggesting this is all going to be in underlined strikeout form, underlined being new language. This order shall be scaled adequately to regulate discharges to impaired surface water and to groundwater. And then it basically says after 1 year, if you don't have 40% of the total acreage or 10% of the growers in Tier 3, the executive officer can adjust that tiering structure. We think that's appropriate. There's some people out there saying, oh, no, we can't live with that uncertainty. Well, I'm saying, well, what happens if people start to game the system? How do you backstop that? And I'm saying that this is reasonable. You've set an expectation of 54 and 13, backstop that. Also, as it goes to tiering, the order adds proximity to public water supply wells. I think here's one of our most serious concerns. You basically move those people that are near public supply wells with high risk from Tier 1 to Tier 2. But if you remember the statements made by staff, Tier 2 does about the same as the old order. So was the old order adequate to deal with nitrate pollution? And I would say the 2004 order was not enough to deal with nitrate pollution. I would suggest to you that it's Tier 3 where people actually need to do things. In other words, there's additional reporting requirements in Tier 2, but there's very little that people need to actually functionally do on the ground to change their practice. They need to report where their nitrate loading or their nitrate index. They need to report some things. They need to do very little. So what's our suggestion? Occasionally this board has challenged me to, instead of just say I don't like it, to say what are the changes that I want. So what we're saying is that this requirement should essentially be stricken from Tier 2 and put in Tier 3. So in other words, you have a new requirement for Tier 3 if the discharger grows crop types with high potential to discharge nitrogen to groundwater and the operation total irrigated acreage is less than 1,000 acres. Because if they're over 1,000 acres, they're already in Tier 3, right? And they're near a contaminated well, they get moved to Tier 3. This deals with groundwater. Moving them from Tier 1 to Tier 2 does not. So now moving on. I do want to say, please stop me if you want to dwell on some of these. I should say that. So now I'm going to be talking about kind of some vocabulary. And I'm jumping around in a numbering system because I'm kind of dealing with things as far as tiering, toxicity, and aquatic life, okay? So the numbering system, I'm not following the numbering system. But you've changed language from the November draft to this March draft, and it basically says effectively control. I can find no definition of what in the heck effectively control means. That bothers me. And I want to know what effectively control means. And especially if we go back to the slide over what are the goals, there is a fundamental difference between how we are dealing with toxicity and how we are dealing with those things that we want to reduce and minimize. We want to eliminate toxic discharges. I don't know if effectively control, when it's applied equally to toxicity, groundwater, surface water, that makes it all seem the same, where there were fundamental differences in the goals and we are supposedly eliminating toxic discharges to surface and groundwaters. So the vocabulary change is tier three dischargers must eliminate individual waste discharges of pesticides and toxic substances to waters of the United States. Effectively control, I don't know what that means. I don't know that anyone knows what it means. And you're applying it to nitrates and toxics. I don't think they're equal under the law. Not a lawyer. Toxicity, continuing along the line of toxicity. This is going to get a little confusing, but applies to, we are worried about this chlorpyrifos and diazinon thing. Let me make it clear that we prefer going back to the February solution of including the entire list. We prefer that solution. The problem with that solution, frankly, is that it will throw a whole bunch of people into Tier 3. It'll throw almost everybody into Tier 3. And I'm not sure that Regional Water Quality Control Board staff is prepared to handle all the growers being in Tier 3. So that's the tiering structure. How do we concentrate on some people? But let's say this another way. How do we, again, backstop this idea so that we eliminate toxicity? How do we disincentivize switching to a toxic pesticide? And so here's our suggestion. Now, the reason that this is confusing is, remember, we had this proximity contaminated well being a new 3C. So in order to keep everything on this slide, I just kind of noted that. But here's what we're saying. After October 1st, any operation that discharges to a water body impaired for toxicity and continues to show water or sediment toxicity in the previous two toxicity tests immediately moves to Tier 3. In other words, if your water continues to be toxic after 2.5 years, and remember, this also accomplishes that idea that we offered up that you liked a while back, that basically said, you know, if they don't have to show their data, because remember, these guys are not doing individual monitoring. These guys are in Tier 2. But then what happens is that they don't eliminate toxicity and they move to Tier 3. So this is a way to backstop, again, them just switching to something equally toxic. Again, I'll reiterate that our group prefers the February solution of the entire list. This is an alternative to that. Vegetated buffers and aquatic life. This is the way it reads now. This is cut and pasted. And basically it says, that there's a couple paragraphs here, and it talks about the basin plan, and it talks about how there's construction needs to have 30 feet. Again, we don't really understand what making a plan really does and what the requirement is. And we also have to keep in mind where we have moved from. The environmental folks came into this room saying that aquatic life was one of our core concerns, partly because of the environmental things that we represent, but also because we don't think that you can improve water quality if you don't restore the vegetation between the receiving water and the pollution source. We think that having healthy riparian, healthy wetlands, vegetated buffers is essential to success. Thank you. So in the February draft order, you had 100, 75, and 50-foot buffers. In November, it went down to 30 feet just around impaired waters. We don't see, maybe we missed it, but we don't see any requirement in this order. It basically says that you'll have a plan and you'll basically talk about, you know, how you're going to protect, but we don't see an actual, you know, specified buffer, and we think that that is important. So we basically eliminate all the chit-chat, and we basically say a vegetated buffer strip of at least 30 feet shall be maintained. Now, tier here means something different. Tier 2 and 3 streams, based on the National Hydrography data set plus, and a vegetated buffer strip of at least 50 feet shall be maintained along lakes, wetlands, estuaries, and other natural bodies of standing water. We simply believe that without a buffer regulation, you're not going to be able to protect water from sediment, the toxics that are attached to that sediment. We think this requirement is essential. Let me basically end, and I think I'm well within my time, so I'll do kind of what Mr. Merkley said, not that it will happen, but that's that I will reserve some time for after everyone has gone to make remarks. That's what he asked for. If I have some time, I'll do the same thing.
We're not going to have time today for that.
I agree.
So if there's anything you want to say today, you better say it now.
I will.
Okay.
Let me basically say that you know, there's a difference of approach. One approach is, look, let us install some management practices. Let us go out there and do some good things. One of the things that you've heard from the growers is that they need certainty. You know, frankly, I think that regulatory certainty is one of the best things that you can offer these guys. That's my opinion. I know that they don't like that idea, but to have a set of baseline regulations that say, here is what we're trying to achieve, you know, go out and do it. That, to me, is your role. Your role is not to protect lettuce. Your role is not to protect agriculture. Your role is to protect water. And I agree that protecting agriculture is important. It's a value that we all share. If that land moves from agriculture, it could potentially be developed. That doesn't serve my conservation interests well either. And it probably doesn't serve water quality well either. But groundwater, it's hurting people. Surface waters, it's hurting otters. It's things out in the ocean. It's certainly hurting, the toxicity is hurting the streams themselves. Let me just finish up by quoting from this study, which is what I have copies for you. And this is up for the Central Valley. But it says, and it's peer-reviewed, both the methodology and the results were peer-reviewed. With the cost of public water service added, the average total household water costs can constitute 4.6% of median household income, more than three times the affordable threshold for drinking water recommended by the U.S. EPA. I'll take another quote. Currently, 100 projects, this is within that region, to address nitrate contamination in community water systems are on the CDPH waiting list with a total cost of $150 million and an average project cost of just over $1 million. These are costs that the discharger is not having to bear. Other people that cannot afford it are having to bear these costs. There is a fundamental right to clean drinking water. there is a big portion of your population in the Central Coast that is not realizing that fundamental right. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Any questions?
Any questions for Mr. Shimek? Okay.
Come on, you ask questions of everybody else.
Okay.
I'll ask you one question. You had stricken out part of it and put it eliminate.
Yes.
Contamination. And if you can't achieve that elimination totally, even if you lay the land fallow and don't farm it and you still don't achieve the elimination, what is your suggestion then?
Well, I think, first of all, part of the suggestion is in the language there, because if it goes fallow, you're going to be dealing with legacy contaminants, right? And it basically excludes, it says, look, if you can show that it's legacy contaminants, you're out. You don't have to deal with it. I'm sorry, that was probably a different place. So you do have to, but let me answer it a different way. I'm not a lawyer, but I believe that it is within the law that basically says toxic discharges are illegal. You can't do it. So I think we have to find a middle ground. I think the goal that we are setting for this five-year period is to eliminate toxic discharges. I don't think we will achieve that every place along the Central Coast. The goal for that goal of eliminating toxic discharges is fundamentally different from the other goals of reduce and minimize.
Well, I think the strawberry people were pointing out that with their use, they wouldn't be adding to or causing the problem, and so consequently, they shouldn't be totally responsible for what's there.
And just sorry.
To follow that up, I know somebody said it's going to take 100 years to probably achieve everything that we'd like to achieve. It probably took us 150 years to get to this point in time today,
right,
with the problems. So it's obvious that we can't cure all this overnight, and it's going to take a long period of time. May take more than 5 years, may take more than 10 years, may take more than 50 years. I don't know. I'm not a scientist.
So I guess I would just answer that in two ways. First of all, I think that we need to parse out the difference between toxicity and nutrients. Toxicity, you're talking about half-life, so the current pesticides in use and being weeks and months. Certainly they can adhere to sediments and last a little bit longer. But we're not talking years. And with nitrates, it's a much literally deeper problem and will be with us for a long time. I think the growers would say that toxicity is a much easier problem to deal with. The second piece that I would say as far as the Strawberry Commission goes is, if you recall, at the meeting in this room, the last time when we had the public meeting, you had one of the larger strawberry growers in the region stand up and say, and this is where the question from Ms. Hunter is very appropriate, what happens not during the growing season, but in between? And he stood up here and said, if I don't have the opportunity to flush the salts that have accumulated below the root zone, I can't grow strawberries. That's what he said. Flush salts. That's a discharge. Now, I'm not saying that we need to send everybody to jail. I'm simply saying that I think that the list of high risk is appropriate right now, and I think that there's the ability for, especially in an industry as progressive as the Strawberry Commission, to prove their way out of Tier 3. And I hope they take that opportunity and will do just that.
Well, I got you one question anyway.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
The drinking water stuff is, this is also the letter that you received from California Department of Public Health. I think that reinforces the importance of dealing with something about nitrates. Thank you
okay.
so much.
Okay, is Ms. McCarthy here? Did she leave already? Mibs McCarthy? Okay. All right.
Okay, so want to keep going with our list of...
Next would be the Environmental Justice Coalition for Water.
Sorry, batch of cards. Deputy, did you still want the individuals to go first?
Page down.
No?
Jump.
What? 12 minutes.
Want him to go? Oh, I just need to know, Deputy, when did you want these other people to speak?
Okay.
Right, we know.
Yes, the green light is on.
Okay.
A lot of people that came with me have left. They were not able to stay the whole day. Unfortunately, they have been here since 8:15, as, of course, a lot of other people have. But I will try my best to represent their comments, and the people that are remaining will try their best to do so as well. Thank you for this opportunity to speak. My name is Deepthi Bhatnagar. I work with the Environmental Justice Coalition for Water, and I wanted to stand up here and speak because the energy I thought was going a little low, and I have a colleague to help change slides. I hope that's okay.
Yes.
Next, please. The Environmental Justice Coalition for Water is a statewide coalition of more than 80 groups, which includes nonprofit organizations, community-based organizations, as well as Native American tribes. And our mandate is to focus on water justice statewide. And that looks like different things in different places. And it has become really clear to you, I'm sure, that in the Central Coast of California, water justice has to do with drinking water contamination issues. So that's what we've been focusing on in this region. Next, please. We convened a water and climate justice convening in Oakland last week. And one of the conclusions that the group came to was that irrigated agriculture in California uses 80% of California's developed water, which means it's a very significant greenhouse gas polluter as well. The reason that I'm bringing this up and the reason that I'm in the room today is that I care very much about agriculture in the Central Coast and in the rest of California. And I'm here because I wanted to stay and I wanted to become sustainable. And part of how it will become sustainable is what I'm going to talk about next. But I wanted to set that up, that it's not just the water quality issues, it's also irrigated ag as a whole that's very unsustainable currently. Next, please. This has been talked about before, but I wanted to reiterate it because these are the people that I represent, and it's my responsibility to bring up that these are real impacts happening to real people. And the last line of this statement is what I wanted to focus your attention on, that the disproportionate burden of nitrate-contaminated water is falling on the most vulnerable, the babies, the infants, and the elderly, and it is very much an issue that needs to be addressed. Next, please. And I wanted to focus, so there's been a lot of conversation, I know, about well data and all of that other stuff. There's been some efforts to raise confusion, but I don't think there is confusion. I think that the nitrate contamination problem and its effects on people is very clear, And I wanted to follow up on something that Angela said, which is that even if the data that we're looking at is public supply wells, which cost a lot of money to drill really deep and to clean up nitrate contamination before providing it to cities, really what I am here to focus on is the smaller systems. And there are thousands of such small systems in the Central Coast region. And these are the ones that are the most vulnerable. Next, please. So we made a public records request to Monterey County Environmental Health just as an example, and we didn't look at 10-year-old data or 20-year-old data. We looked at their latest data source, which was 2009 to 2010, and we looked at their data for nitrate contamination for all the wells that they sampled in this particular year. We made a public records request, and then we also found out the information is available on the website, so that link is up for anyone to see. They found 83 water systems with nitrates that were over 45 milligrams per liter. Next, please. But I wanted to point out two additional facts about the data. One of those is up on your screen right now, and I want you to see the scale of the problem. So the red bars represent 83 different water systems, and the 23 in the first bar are actually in addition. They're 40 to 45, which means they're also very close to the limit. And I want you to see that this goes all the way till 300 plus. This is the extent of the problem that we were talking about a little while ago. Next, please. And this is the other thing I wanted you to focus on. It's a scatter plot looking at how many connections was that particular well feeding versus the nitrate contamination. As you can see, the most severe nitrate contamination is in the wells with the least amount of connections, which means that it's, as I was saying earlier, it's the small systems that are being very negatively impacted. And the cost of treating every single individual small system, as you can imagine, would be very high, and I'll come to that in a second. Next, please. So this is it. How do small communities get clean water? We don't have a lifeline water rate in California. And you've heard people come up here and talk to you about either drinking contaminated water, paying a whole lot for replacement water, or what was the third thing? Paying very high water rates. And you'll hear, hopefully, testimony on all three of those today. And I wanted to bring up one fact which is not in the slides because I also just received this information. It's an extension of the report that Steve Shimek just showed to you, which was for the Central Valley. But I had the Pacific Institute look at the Clean Water State Revolving Fund and see how many applications were pending for nitrate cleanup drinking water projects for the Central Coast region. And that number is 61.4 million. These are just the people who have applied, and we use the Clean Water State Revolving Fund quite a bit. If we encounter a small community that does not have a safe drinking water source, we would try and apply to that fund. So actually, it's very interesting, the point that got brought up earlier, Dr. Hunter brought it up, about acting at the local level, and we have this phrase, think global, act local, which means keep your encompass everything while you're thinking about the problem, and then you act locally on it. So we are acting locally with small communities that don't have clean drinking water right now because we think that's unpardonable. At the same time, I'm here to tell you that this is what it costs. Right now, the application spending with the Clean Water State Revolving Fund for nitrate contaminated water in the Central Coast is $61.4 million. So when we are talking about undue financial burden, I think that would count as undue financial burden to the state and to everyone of the state as well. Next, please. So I wanted to address which draft provides true environmental justice, which means which draft will be truly protective of groundwater quality and of the people that depend on it. We truly support the February 2010 draft as the most protective of groundwater and surface water quality. And there have been many rollbacks since last year's draft. But we still do support the March 2011 draft, but with the required revisions that you heard Steve Shimmick just talk about, we are signed on to that letter as well. And we support those. We support the March 2011 draft with those required revisions. The ag alternative, I have had conversations with ag representatives about it, and I have been told that we cannot meet water quality standards. Hence, there are no water quality standards in the plan because we cannot meet them, which tells me, when I think about eyes on the prize, what is the ultimate reason why we're here in this room? We want to clean up water. We want to have acceptable water quality standards and for the water to meet it. And if I'm being told that we cannot meet it, hence there are no water quality standards, it's not acceptable to me, which is why I do not support that draft at all, and I do not support the process that has been outlined here because it does not have that element of groundwater monitoring and then following up to see how to improve that data that has been received. Next, please. And I wanted to take it a little bit broader to what's going on at the state level, because we're a statewide organization. We have those perspectives. We're working in different regions on the same irrigated lands issues. The Human Right to Water bill has been filed in the legislature, and it's actually a package of bills that works to ensure water justice. One of my colleagues from the Central Valley said that declaring a human right to water is one thing. Figuring out how to guarantee access to it is essential, and I think that's where this board comes in. Next, please. And the reason I bring this up is that I feel what's happening, this process that's being undertaken by the regional board, is very much in line with this positive water policy that's being worked at the state level, and including elements of environmental justice. This is happening at the state level, so the fact that it's happening in your ag order process is very important. And I want to say that your task is very difficult, as we've heard in the room today. There's been tons of heartbreaking testimony. There's been tons of very angry, very difficult testimony. And I know that your task is very difficult and very politically charged, not to mention, but it's really commendable. And I think there have been some attacks on the staff today, and I want to say that we stand with staff and we support the work that they've been able to do in prioritizing human health and drinking water concerns. And you are a regulatory agency, so I would really urge you to do exactly that, to regulate, and to regulate ag in this case. I was listening to the radio in the morning, and there are really big things happening in the world. There's earthquakes and tsunamis and nuclear threat in Japan. There's God alone knows what's happening in Libya, and John Bertrand Aristide is going home to Haiti today, which is a really big step. And for us to have to worry about whether or not the water that we drink or that we feed our babies will kill us or will impact us in the long term, I think is something we deserve more than that. And I really urge you to accept the staff to the March 2011 draft with the required revisions in the interest of environmental justice and drinking water protection. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Any board questions? Okay, thank you very much. Next speaker is with the Coastal Alliance. And then Channel Keeper after that. And then the Central Coast Alliance versus...
I'm with the Central Coast Alliance. Is there a different Coastal Alliance?
It says Coastal Alliance. Roger.
There are two, yes.
Okay.
Get 16 minutes. I'm asking, I'm with the Coastal Alliance United for Sustainable Economy, but I don't know if somehow that got maybe written twice.
Okay, maybe that's a shortcut. 8 minutes. Yes. I saw right through it.
Cut on to me. I think there's only one Coastal Alliance in the room.
Is there two? Okay.
All right.
All right.
Okay. That one.